I often remember what one of my friends and colleagues, Christopher Titmus, said about going the length of India, which would be 2 or 3 days on a train, to attend a Dharma talk by Krishnamurti. And then he got back on the train and went back up. And for Kator, who's been helping with Gyan, so one of the people that without whom this retreat would not be possible. Sometimes we manage the childcare for her to get here or for Summer to be here. Sometimes childcare logistics are more challenging than 3 days on an Indian train. Are there any questions or comments?
I'm not sure if this question is about what we might call positive and negative thoughts, feelings, and emotions, or if it's a question about discernment or happiness. I remember a couple of years ago a practice being useful of literally sweeping irritation, embarrassment sort of off the edge of the cliff, and sometimes I'd peek over and make sure they were still down there.
Literally sweeping, you mean in your mind, the image of...
In my mind.
Literally
yeah.
Sweeping. Just...
and I spoke with you yesterday, on this retreat, having this encyclopedia happening.
Why don't you say a few more words about that so that everyone's on the same page? Encyclopedia means everything.
An encyclopedia of sort of the possibility of physical and mental ideas, feelings, thoughts. So embarrassment, revulsion, jealousy, irritation, just throughout the day and watching them. And so my question is about, there's also been experience of contentment and happiness and marvel. And I don't want to sweep those things off the cliff, which makes me, A, think, it makes sense that I'm no longer sweeping things off the cliff as a practice. There's that entry in the encyclopedia, or my alphabet book, I for irritation, A for appreciation.
Right.
Maybe it's a question about distinguishing between something passing and something that's solidly, but not solidly present.
The difference between something that covers up our true nature and something that's giving a whisper of our true nature. Is that what you mean?
Yes. And I do want to say that there's a sense of wanting to practice and have that evidence for myself of, is this true heart's release? Or is this passing? But it feels like it'd be helpful to have a sense of practice.
There's another phrase, again, from this verses on faith mind. Like the sure heart's release, it talks about the mind's essential peace. And I love the phrase because it goes so against our usual experiences of our mind. The possibility that the mind's essential peace is sometimes disturbed. P-E-A-C-E. Not peace. Almost two opposite words with the same sound. So first, what I love about your question is that there's a sense that it's possible to distinguish between what are the ups and downs that, whether up or down, is an obstruction to experiencing clearly what is, and that there might be another kind of experience that is similar to an up, but is actually like going into the depth, let's say, or more expansive than that, repetitive cycle. You may have heard the word samsara now that it's been a perfume name for a while. And people seem to name all kinds of things. It's like, if they really knew what they were talking about, it's not that glamorous. One time I heard that it's a whirlpool. So people talk about the cycle of suffering, which is kind of a dry, abstract phrase. But whirlpool of suffering, I think we kind of get the point. And we get dizzy and we drown. So that kind of repeating the same thing in a downward spiral, in a way that has a negative momentum, a destructive momentum. And then the possibility of something that we can feel that is not a whirlpool, but maybe a kind of buoyancy. There's so many different points, I hope I remember them. I guess I also want to say that this question is kind of like an entrance. It's a big entrance. It's important. And I immediately think of Gautam Buddha again, when he'd been doing practices that were painful in order to achieve superhuman states in the language of the texts. And then he realized he hadn't achieved any superhuman states. He was doing crazy things that really, really, really hurt with the breath. And then he was having this question that you have today. I love how when I speak about something here in India, I start having a little Indian English. He was having this experience that you are having today, madam. The very same. But first there was this dawning on him that painful hadn't worked, first of all. That was the first dawning. And it wasn't like the more painful, the more superhuman. He kind of got that. And so instead of just being busy, like upping the volume on painful, on the mode he'd chosen, he kind of got that it hadn't gotten superhuman into him or brought it out or anything. And then the second dawning was, maybe there's another way, which sounds really stupid when we hear, like, maybe there's another way. Good idea. Maybe we could stop hurting ourselves. And maybe that's not just the end of the story, we lost. So a kind of confidence that not only did I just waste 6 years of my life and really hurt myself, nearly kill the body by starvation, and that didn't work at all, but maybe there's another way. And then the way that the mind can be helpful, something floats into the mind. And what floated into his mind was a memory of that kind of peace, a kind of goodness that wasn't an up and a down, that wasn't a downward spiral, it wasn't the beginning of a downward spiral. It wasn't a movement from a place of lack. It was a kind of bubbling up of the peace of fulfillment, of already being okay. And then again, another dawning, maybe that could be the way. So all of those, it's like, it feels like dangerous ground, every single one of those steps. Maybe this isn't working. Maybe there's another way. Maybe this could be the other way. And he felt fear of that goodness. And so be alert to feeling fear of that goodness. Because as we've kind of, it's been coming up here and there over the talks the last few days, it's an untamable goodness. And if we try to trap it, then we kill it. But if we accept that it sometimes bubbles up, and that it could even be a way, it is. And then the cool thing about the Buddha's description of his story as it's been passed down is that he talks about his way really specifically. And so at first, by following that joy for no reason, where there still might be a lot of thinking, but there's real sense of pleasure in the body. And pleasure in the body sometimes includes sexual energy. So people are, sometimes come to interviews and they're like, I don't know if I'm doing something wrong, but I just had an orgasm. And they're relieved to know that it's not that it goes on every day necessarily, but it has happened before, that even orgasm can come for no reason. And then that joy, if we keep letting it lead us gently, if we accept our this underlying magnetism towards this pull instead of that pull into the whirlpool that we have accepted so long, the whole thing keeps getting lighter and lighter. So there's eventually less outright pleasure going along with this stillness, and there's more brightness and stillness, and then there's just less and less and less and less, and there's more and more honesty. And finally, this is how the mind gets malleable, wieldy, and bright, the words that we had from yesterday, by letting this leading, this other pull, happen to us. And not letting the whirlpool happen, or letting that happen less often. Freaking out less when it does happen. There's less and less to hold on to, so we could say more and more lightness. Less and less of time. And so much space that there's, you could say, where is space if there's not limit? And each time, just like we had yesterday with the woman who would sign the contract with each phase of her practice and spend enough time in that phase for the next to come, spending enough time with less, and then enough time with less and less, and enough time with less and less and less. Letting it happen, not trying to go running ahead. And it can be hard to leave behind that really palpable joy for the lightness of another kind of, we could call it joy, or we could call it just lightness. It sometimes comes across as more of like, there's no thing. And sometimes it comes more across like, this is everywhere. I am everything kind of thing. And then again, more honest. We're with the fact of our experience that we don't know if we exist or don't exist. We don't know if we're really existing or really not existing. And we can't honestly land on either page. So the lightness of our actual perception starts to come through more clearly. The light, the way that, yes, there's color, but there's nothing I can really grasp about color. And even if I try to describe a color, I can't even really describe a color unless you're seeing the same color. So even perception is allowed to be that undefinable. And then the last kind of step is a kind of dawning on us that all of this journey started because there was some kind of intentional practice of some kind. I set my feet on this path of, okay, maybe this is a way. And I signed all those contracts and I went through all of that. And all that's left at the end is just that little place that we kind of hooked on, that we needed to hook on, that we can unhook. And then that's the end. So in that, that was what happened to some people. Don't try to match yourself to that. You can describe it 20 years afterwards. Sometimes there's even a 12-year waiting period after everything is done before you would say anything about your experience. Getting used to the absence of suffering. So this ties in to the question that Michal had this morning also, that I saw a few people nodding. How do I know where it's appropriate to try my best? And how do I know where it's appropriate to let go my best, the best that I can? And is there a difference? And in a way, there's not really a difference. That we try our best to let go our best. But sometimes letting go takes some kind of pressure. Not in the usual way of I should, but my whole life is pointing this way. And to go against the force of the whirlpool, I better start kicking pretty hard. So there are a couple of those imperfections of mind that obscure wisdom that we've been talking about over the days. Well, we talked about the main one, the lack, not enoughness. And you've seen the sheet on the notice board if you're on retreat, and you could look if you're visiting on the notice board. It's hanging there in the instructions from previous days. Five things that happen when we are trying our best to let go our best. So two of them are really relevant to the conversation about effort and letting go. Restlessness and what they call sloth and torpor, which I always get an image of an animal, sloth. Then torpor is just another animal there. Doing their thing. And in that same text where greed, not enoughness, was compared to being in debt, restlessness is compared to being in slavery, where you can't go where you want to go, and you're forced to go where you don't want to go. And with maybe instead of pressure, we could say staying power. With some kind of staying power through that turbulence where we've been pushed around, we've been not free to go where we feel called to go. And not only that, we've been forced to go where we didn't want to go. With staying power through that, not believing that is what we are, even when the mind takes the shape of restlessness, so slavery, knowing that that's not what we deeply are. It's not the only thing that could happen. In the text, the description is that we're freed from slavery with no damage to our person or property, which I love. And I also love how sloth and torpor is compared to a prison house, so being imprisoned where you can't go, you can't get out, you can't go anywhere, and how similar those are. How it's almost the same thing, but one's in movement and one is in stagnation or stuckness. And how often that is really one thing. Like, I might be stuck in a repetitive movement. I can't stop going to check the notice board or whatever. Maybe I've got mail with the phones. Do I have a message? Not on retreat, of course. And this so-called sloth and torpor, how it's often such a strong resistance to something or such an energy that's so wound up that we either can't move or we're completely exhausted. And so we're not awake to ourselves. And again, with staying power, we find ourselves freed from prison with no damage to our person and property. And we're happy about it. I like how they state in the text, and you are happy to be freed from prison. Like, yeah, right. So I'd really love to really investigate what is laziness and what is restlessness and how different are they. So here the question often will come, why am I wasting my time doing nothing? Shouldn't I be getting more out of this? And why can't I just rest? So the normal way would be, why can't I just rest? Or why can't I just do something? Why are they not allowing me to just do something? Why are they keeping me in prison here? And then we would put pressure on ourselves in the normal way, in the way that's based on right and wrong, thinking of right and wrong. And we get more stuck and more restless and more exhausted and more wound up. So sometimes just the feeling, because it's actually really strong images, even though it's just these little lines, a really strong image of being freed from slavery that day, that feeling. Being freed from prison and coming out and finding that you're not just alive, but there's not damage. And if we could take as seriously these inner states, what would allow us to take it that seriously, to realize that in a way it is a life and death moment, and another life and death moment. Not that I should get out of prison or I should get out of slavery. That's the pressure that doesn't work. We've tried it uncountable times. But that I could. And that no matter how long I've been in prison, no matter how long I stay in prison, there's that okayness that's not in prison, that doesn't know the word. So getting to know what puts us in prison, what puts us into slavery, what helps us walk out, when we usually just put pressure that doesn't work, then we would be likely to just give up. A little bit sneaky. But it does take practice to feel the reality of our connection to this kind of deep okayness that is with us behind the scenes, no matter what. And it takes confidence then that I could be free from slavery, I could be free from prison. Now. I can be with a couple of things. And one is a little and sometimes a lot more willingness to do what's not convenient, to not go for what's convenient. And secondly, and the only way we have the kind of inspiration, the oxygen to actually walk through that wall that isn't a wall, or break that chain that's not a chain, is to know that it's not just me and my struggle with my restlessness and my sloth and torpor. And I'll give a statement from a teacher from Canada, John de Ruyter, that can also broaden the conversation, bring in a really challenging area of relationship, and also kind of up the ante in a different kind of way. Not just more suffering, in case that's going to help me be superhuman, but more maybe we can. So relationship is the most common topic that people would love to talk about. Whether they actually do or don't depends on their personality and courage and how long they've known me and that kind of thing. But it usually ends up being, not for everyone, but for the vast majority of people, it's the main challenge. I used to only be able to say that I knew one couple that were just a good couple. And that number's growing, I'm happy to say. There's like 4 or 5 that I know. I'll be happy if let me know if you're another one. I'll believe you. So someone goes to John de Ruyter in one of his teaching times and says, "My marriage is falling apart. I don't know if we're going to stay together, and I'm trying to figure out what's my part of the dynamic." Like all you're really earnestly trying to figure out why your life just fell apart. You're willing to see your side of the story. And that's good. And the person also is like, I don't know. This is in a book, Unveiling Reality, so it's really striking on the page. Like, I don't know. I don't even really know what I'm asking. And then John de Ruyter says, what you're experiencing now is not just about now, but it's the core reality that you entered the marriage in. That's how you actually entered the marriage, on a deep level. Not the deepest level, but in the deep psyche. And then the person kind of interrupts and said, "Oh, well, we got married because I got pregnant." And John's like, "That is so superficial. That's no big deal. That's nothing. What's really the problem is that you went into marriage for you. And marriage is not for you." I just love when someone will say this kind of crazy statement. That marriage is not for you. But some deeper place in us that's bigger than who we think we are, that has a need also. So there's needs of the body, there's needs of the mind, needs of the heart, and needs of the deep being. And we see what kind of havoc happens when we don't address any of those needs, when they're not allowed to be met through slavery and prison and debt and those kind of things. (Clears throat) But that even something that seems so personal as marriage, like we would normally think that if someone's really on a spiritual path, they don't need marriage, they don't need intimate relationship. Like, really, really, they should be a monk or a nun. And so I love that John is saying there's something in the deep being, not in everyone, because there are the genuine monks and nuns, whether in robes or not. But in many of us, there is a deep need of the inner being, of the deep being to express itself in truth with another being. So not for you, but for something deeper than you, through you. So it's again, it's like those the two flames coming together. Who we think we are meeting something else that comes through us, shines through us. And it's curious to have spent so many years in India and have so many Indian friends and have gotten so used to the arranged marriage system even as it starts to change. But often now, even when the marriage is called a love marriage, it's really like love marriage plus arranged marriage mixed together. Like the parents meet, the two families meet and decide if this is really going to be okay, and they check the astrology. And so it's kind of love marriage, but they call it love marriage. And it's not that I would wish on any of us an arranged marriage, but I'm not sure I could totally wish a love marriage on us either. And seeing all of our experimentation so far hasn't gotten very far. Just now it's been so long that I'm not exactly from anywhere anymore. I feel more at home in this big, ugly Indian city than anywhere else on the planet, Lucknow. And I love to come here and do some shopping and get some, you know, like organic toothpaste, and can't get that in Spain. And be with you amazing people, of course. And my family. But it does seem like what's happening is a direct, as an overall direction, is that there's a lot of single moms. And so I'm just curious about this staying power, this phrase. And what could give us some staying power that might be good for everyone. So that we don't just give up too soon. So that we have enough confidence to ride through the turbulence to get to what's actually happening. Robert Fripp is a musician that probably people who are into music know. King Crimson. Is he famous? No? Okay, not anymore? Okay. My friend Nathan Glide showed me this piece by him where he talks about having an insight, staying at a friend's place in New York City. And I have the image that he's like crashing on the sofa or whatever. So he describes, he leaps up from the sofa and realizes that about music, that it comes into our lives. So he's a musician, it comes into his life like a friend. Always present and always available, but never pushy. So, and then he does actually compare it to any other way that we tune into life and creativity comes through us. He said, you might be musician or carpenter or bookseller. Those were the three examples he gave. We could add farmer and a few other wholesome things. So music, or we could say life, comes into our life like that kind of friend, the one who's not pushy, who's available and present. I hope we have some friends like that. And that was his insight, but he said it really changed how music happened for him. He said he stopped rushing around trying to get the bright ideas. And he started to focus on training in relaxing so that his sensitivity could immediately pick up the creative impulses, which is exactly what we're doing here. So I was like, thank you for describing that so well. So I think that sometimes that insight and different versions of that insight are needed to give us the willingness, the inspiration, the energy to focus on training in relaxing so that our sensitivity can work in the way that it's kind of best, at its best. Like the perfectly tuned string that resounds. With music. So there's that kind of eagerness. And I remember the lineage of the word audacity, and that in there was the avidness that has the root of relation to avariciousness, like, and greed. But originally comes from thanks and gentleness. So feeling that kind of lineage, thanks and gentleness, that we have that friend available and not pushy, present, and not telling us what's right and wrong. So that there still remains the freedom to walk out of prison. And the freedom to walk out of slavery. We can pause and turn on the air conditioning. Whatever. This is very much a random observation that I have about the United States, but so forgive me if I'm really inaccurate, but it seems like the one generally accepted area of life to make a bad investment, that means like put so much energy in and get seemingly so little in return, is in parenting. And everywhere else, including work and other relationships, including partnerships, it seems like we're somehow expected to make a so-called good investment. That means that it's about me and what's good for me in a very superficial way. So if we could take that observation, which might not be totally true, it might have some truth in it. Thank goodness there's still one culturally acceptable area to give what seems to be too much. And apply that kind of heart more widely. Because a culture is made up by people. And so there can start to be this tide of desperation in intimate relationships, for example, and also in work, also in relation to money, where it obviously isn't working this way. It obviously is not working this way. One of my Indian friends says that if we keep going this direction, that soon relationships will be getting so much shorter and shorter and shorter that they will start to be 24 hours. As considered to be a long relationship. So giving myself fully for something that's not just for me, but in a deeper way is for all of me, not leaving out the deepest part. If we could think of the example of parenting and apply it to friendship and work and notice that this is hard, but what if I thought that I couldn't just replace myself, they can just have another friend, I'm done. I have some, I know some people in New York who actually say that to their children, I can't be your mommy right now, I'm done. I'll be back, you know, in a while. Not because we should just suffer, so not just to be in more pain, but trying to reach for that confidence more deeply, the confidence that there's something deep in us that wants to express the creative impulse that we could be more and more sensitive to, more and more quick to let it through. The lighter the touch with all of that, the more staying power. The lighter the touch, the more possibility of that confidence. I would also like to say, since on the topic of children in this culture, it's kind of, by the way, and kind of intrinsic to the talk. Isn't there a huge gap in the way that we take care of the young people in adolescence and in young adulthood, both two places? Aren't they kind of left without enough both support and that kind of pressure to have confidence that they can? So the love of challenge. And then that between finishing school, whether it's high school or college or whatever, and then suddenly you're supposed to know how to live the so-called adult life. But no one has really, they don't have classes on that. I mean, at least not where I went to school. Nothing practical was allowed to be taught in high school. Typing I learned in high school, thank goodness. Now I'm sure kids learn that like in 10th, 5th grade or even before. So I love to just have the sense of this big, wide, it's not really a net, it's some kind of like a disc that just is catching, what is it, you know, that statement, what we could have learned in kindergarten, but also what we could have learned when we were 10, 11, 12, 13, and what we could have learned when we were like 22. If there had been that kind of friendship, a friend who is available and present and not pushy, so that there's trust in the person, then there could be trust in the life, even through all that turbulence of the hormones and then the really drastic change for most people in this country when there's a lot of residential college. Suddenly, you have to pay the rent, get a job, pay your loan, etc., as you know. The trust, the non-gravitation towards convenience, the gravitation towards challenge, the appropriate challenge. And what's important in that recovering the childhood love of challenge, so just the simple examples where Gan will be bored after one time walking on a kind of balance beam. If he can do it, then he needs to have something harder the second time. And the third time again, there needs to be a second balance beam with a little bit wider step. It's a need. And it helps our being stretch. It helps the smaller us stretch so that it starts to reach towards the limitless. And so there's in practice, in meditation practice, where we practice relaxing so that our sensitivity can receive aliveness. With confidence. And then at a certain point, that needing to be stretched falls apart because we're in touch with the already that wide. It's not then that the challenge ends. The challenge, in a way, multiplies. It becomes more dimensional. Because it's so clear that it's not just about me and my challenge. So in the acceptance of challenge and the way it kind of changes our blood, the quality of our blood is more alive in that. It's important to differentiate between, we could use the words pain versus suffering. Pain being, or discomfort being, something that happens every day. And suffering being, there's that kind of flippant phrase, suffering is optional. Suffering being what gets added on top of both painful and pleasant situations. Suffering being, this shouldn't be happening. My partner shouldn't speak to me this way. My partner should express love in that way. My friends should be less pushy and more available and present. My mind should be in its essential peace instead of in 1,000 pieces. So sometimes we can kind of let ourselves catch up on the school that we didn't have and just feel, what if in adolescence there had been some support around sexuality as a natural thing, as a dangerous thing, as a deep thing, some support around friendship and group dynamics and our deep nature. And what if there had been just built in something that touched our love of challenge without making us feel too small? So confidence and challenge, confidence and challenge. Where it starts to be not just that life hits us in the face with a challenge and then we accept it with a little bit of whiplash, but that our deep inner being starts to come up with the challenge with a grin on our face for the crazy idea. Are there any questions or comments?
Something fundamental about how that kind of deep rest and aliveness, and then the sort of cultivation of awareness through meditation, like where they connect, interplay, don't connect. And I've been sitting with it for a couple days pretty intensely, but and I couldn't say all the things from the talk that sparked it again. But there's a whole thing of like dropping below levels of consciousness in the deep rest, as opposed to like when I'm engaged in a more active meditation practice, and then how my intellect like is or isn't able to receive things or make sense of things. And so I feel like some of this I kind of like, oh, I know what Jaya would say, but I need you to say it again. It's something like even today I notice like my intellect is like really trying to process what you're talking about, and like maybe half the time I'm like, okay, and the other half the time I'm just like, what? And it's not that you're not making sense. I'm pretty sure you are making sense. But I've like dropped somewhere else maybe. Yeah. So anyway, I think there's something really fundamental in my own practice that I'm not fully like living into or seeing or understanding or something. Yeah.
Here. So I would make a little bit of a word change in the way that we normally practice awareness that we could call mindfulness rather than calling it meditation. And when we play with deep rest, and sometimes we're asleep, and that's not meditation, but it's a good way towards. Sometimes we're in these in-between states, which also sometimes is meditation, sometimes is not meditation, but it's a good way in. When the mind is more active, I think it's a really good time to apply mindfulness practice. And that helps to let our conscious experience of our lives to be more still and more clear and also more vibrant. So, more receptive to the deeper wisdom, less caught in the habit energies. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. Awareness is something that already is, and then it's the meeting of our conscious experiencing, our ability to consciously experience, so our sensitivity, and that awareness. And that, I'm going like this, but it's usually more like this. That we're not sure if we were just asleep, but we know that we just woke up and we're lying in meditation and it's very still, like a still lake. And it's very clear, but not thinking. There's often a sweetness or a brightness or a lightness, breeziness, sweetness. And then we start thinking. And that little glimpse is a glimpse of awareness. It's a glimpse of, it's also, well, we could say it's a glimpse of the direction of meditation. Partly because there's not the me doing. And there's more room for the, let's say, the deeper, more inner. Which is not confined to the individual. So in the listening, reflecting, digesting, trying to make sense of, trying to apply teachings to life, so trying to put into practice what resonates with us, and please throwing away everything else that doesn't resonate with you. There is a strong possibility that sometimes teachings come across and they're not trapped in the words, and they come across not just in the words, and they resonate not just in the words, and the words become irrelevant. So sometimes we're listening and we fall asleep, and it's because that one thing that we just missed was really for us, and that's sloth and torpor. It's like when you're in the middle of a sentence and your mind goes off. Like, what was I saying? And then you know that was important and that's got a charge and let's go back. And other times we're listening the way that you're describing, I think. And there's a sense that it could make sense if I were in a different space. Not that I always make sense, and please feel free to ask questions if I don't. But it's that other kind of sensitivity, receiving. And it's also not only receiving. That's a beautiful thing about Dharma talk, is that it's not only that you are there receiving what I'm putting out. There's a really beautiful way that creativity happens, that I am, in the word of yesterday, obedient to. I incline towards that whisper. That's our whisper, to the best of my ability. Thank you. Thank you for being here.